Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a look at the impressive career of Mike Garrig-Gordabiel, a leading researcher in child and adolescent psychology.
Yes.
And, you know, you gave us sections from her CV, and it's amazing. They really do read like a timeline of just impactful discoveries over decades.
Absolutely.
So our mission today is to kind of unearth the key themes, those, you know, aha moments that can really, truly make a difference in children's lives.
Yeah, I think that's what's so fascinating about this, right, is that we're not just going to, you know, list achievements. We're going to really trace the evolution of her thinking, those patterns that emerge.
Yes.
And really how it built upon itself to make a difference.
Exactly. So let's jump right in, starting with her early work.
All right.
Even back in 1992, her doctoral thesis earned her the Extraordinary Doctorate Award.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
She designed a playful psychoeducational intervention program.
I love that.
For 6 and 7 year olds. Already, I feel like we're seeing a theme here.
Yeah.
This theme of play, which we see throughout her career.
It's striking right from the start how she combined a deep understanding of child development.
Yeah.
With these really rigorous research methods.
Yeah.
And already in her thesis, she's showing significant improvement in, you know, cooperation and social skills.
Wow.
But even in self-concept in these kids.
So she was proving with data that play isn't just fun and games. It's actually crucial.
Yeah.
I'm guessing she didn't stop there.
Oh, absolutely not. Just 2 years later in 94, she receives her first National Educational Research Award.
Wow.
This time, she designed a program to boost altruism and creativity in 8 to 10-year-olds.
So now this is where I get really curious.
Yeah.
What did these programs actually look like?
Well, this particular program involved a series of activities designed to kind of encourage that creative thinking, but within cooperative interactions.
I like that.
And the results, again, pretty remarkable. Not only did altruism increase, but so did self-concept, communication skills, and both verbal and visual creativity.
It's like those light bulbs going on.
Yes.
Playful learning sparking all these positive changes. Like it really makes you think, why isn't play more central to our education systems?
That's a great point. And I think her work really makes a compelling case.
Yeah.
For this power of play-based learning, especially in those early years.
Yeah.
But our curiosity didn't stop there. Over the next decade, she tackles even bigger questions.
Okay.
Expanding into psychomotor development, human rights education, and the complexities of adolescent personality.
Talk about range. Did her approach to research change as she explored these new areas?
You know, what remained constant was this commitment to scientific rigor. She really aimed for reliability in her findings, used carefully designed studies with control groups, repeated measures.
Okay.
And one particular finding during this period, the relationship between intelligence and psychomotor skills actually weakens as children grow older.
That's surprising. You would think that those would go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Does that have implications for how we teach? Do we need to focus more on physical development alongside the intellectual?
Those are definitely questions worth pondering.
Yeah.
Especially for, you know, educators and anyone involved in shaping these learning environments.
For sure.
Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about her work in human rights education.
Okay.
Which is an area where her passion for social justice really shines through.
I'm eager to hear about this. You mentioned she earned her third National Educational Research Award.
Yes.
For this work back in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a pretty substantial project.
It was. She developed a comprehensive program for adolescents involving weekly sessions.
Wow.
Over an entire school year.
Imagine the dedication.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And the impact was profound. The program led to significant reductions in prejudice, increased empathy among participants.
Wow.
And improvement in both social skills and self-esteem.
It sounds like she was creating real change, not just studying it.
Exactly. And think about the relevance of this research to what we're seeing in society today.
Yeah.
These issues like prejudice, anxiety, and social situations, antisocial behavior.
They're constantly in the news.
All the time.
Yeah.
And her work really demonstrates the potential for positive change through these targeted interventions.
It almost feels like she was ahead of her time anticipating these challenges that we'd be facing.
I think so.
Did she just focus on designing these programs, or was she involved in other aspects of research as well?
Her expertise really extended far beyond program design.
Okay.
She also took on leadership roles, directing research groups, focusing on things like psychological assessment, you know, the tools we use to measure things like personality or well-being and the evaluation of intervention programs.
So ensuring that both the research methods and the programs themselves were top-notch. Makes sense. Did any particular research group stand out to you during this phase of her career?
One that I think really captures her commitment to addressing these complex societal challenges was the Psychology and Society in the 21st Century Unit.
Okay.
And they were tackling, I mean, some of the biggest issues we face. Violence and gender.
Oh, wow.
Psychosocial factors in health.
So how our minds and our social lives affect our well-being.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even how beliefs and values are transmitted across generations.
Wow. That unit's research sounds incredibly relevant to our lives today.
Oh, for sure.
It's impressive how she brought together researchers to tackle these big picture questions.
Absolutely.
Was her work limited to Spain, or did she collaborate internationally as well?
Oh, that's a good question. She was very much involved in international collaborations.
Okay.
Notably, she worked with researchers in Argentina.
Okay.
On programs aimed at fostering resilience and life skills in adolescents.
Giving them the tools to thrive.
That's exactly, in a complex world. And this showcases her dedication to making a positive impact.
Yeah.
Globally, not just within her own region.
That's inspiring. She clearly saw the value in sharing knowledge and working together across borders.
Yeah.
But let's go back to something you mentioned earlier, psychological assessment tools.
Okay.
Those are crucial for understanding people and helping them, right?
Absolutely.
What contributions did she make in that area?
Well, her work on assessment tools was incredibly important. She was involved in adapting existing tools, making sure they were valid and reliable for use in Spanish-speaking populations.
Okay.
And one key contribution was her work on the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or the MMPI-2.
Ah, the MMPI. I've heard of that.
Right.
Yeah.
It's widely used. So making sure that these tools are accurate and culturally sensitive.
Crucial.
Absolutely. And it speaks to the breadth of her impact, from designing and evaluating these intervention programs to improving the very tools we use to assess psychological well-being.
That's a great reminder that research isn't just about publishing papers. It's about driving positive change in the real world.
Exactly.
Before we move on, I'm curious, what stands out to you most about her career so far?
You know, what strikes me is her ability to blend that rigorous research with a deep understanding of children's needs.
Yeah.
You know, her focus on play-based interventions shows a real sensitivity to how children learn best.
Yeah.
And then her work on human rights education really demonstrates that dedication to building a more just and compassionate world.
It's like she's not just a researcher, but an advocate, you know, using her knowledge to fight for children's well-being and to empower them, and her work on resilience and life skills.
Yes.
So crucial, especially in today's world.
Absolutely. And this is just the beginning.
Yeah.
There's so much more to uncover about her research, particularly how she explored the ways that context, you know, family, school, the environment a child grows up in can impact your development. We'll dive into that next.
Let's do it.
Okay.
So we've been exploring Mate Garagordo-Beal's incredible career. And it's clear that she's really passionate about understanding not just individual kids, but how their whole world shapes who they become.
Absolutely.
You mentioned this idea of context.
Yes.
Can you unpack that a bit more?
It's fascinating how she weaves this idea through so much of her research.
Okay.
It's not just about, you know, what's going on inside a child's head,
right?
But it's about their family, their school, even the city they live in.
Wow.
All these pieces kind of come together to create this unique developmental puzzle.
I'm starting to see the bigger picture here. Do you have a specific study that really brings this to life?
Well, one that comes to mind is her 2005 study on empathy in 10 to 12-year-olds.
Okay.
And she wasn't just measuring how empathetic these kids were.
Right.
But how empathy connected to their social behavior, self-concept, emotional stability, even their intelligence and creativity.
That's taking a much broader view than just saying, this child is good at understanding others' feelings.
Exactly.
What kind of patterns emerged from that research?
Well, she found that kids with high levels of empathy tended to be more what we call pro-social.
Okay.
You know, those helpful, considerate kids.
Got it.
They were also more assertive, had stronger self-concepts, and were generally more emotionally stable.
I can see how all of that would be connected.
Yeah.
If you can understand and share the feelings of others,
right,
you're probably going to have more positive social interactions overall.
Exactly. And it wasn't just about individual traits.
Okay.
She also looked at peer groups,
mm-hmm.
who the kids themselves identified as the most helpful and kind.
Okay.
And guess what? Those good kids also tended to be high in empathy.
So the social environment matters too.
Yes.
Being surrounded by caring, empathetic people can reinforce those qualities in a child. Were there any other kind of interesting connections that jumped out at you?
One that really struck me was the link between empathy and this ability to analyze negative emotions.
Okay.
So the kids who were good at understanding why someone might be sad or angry.
Yeah.
Not just recognizing the emotion, right?
Right.
Those were the kids who also scored higher in empathy.
That's fascinating. It's like taking empathy a step further.
Yeah.
Not just feeling it, but understanding
the complexity.
The complexity of it.
That's real emotional intelligence.
Right. It's not just about having a big heart.
Right.
It's about using your head to understand those emotions more deeply.
Exactly. Now, this study also highlighted something that we see a lot in empathy research.
Yeah. Hmm.
Gender differences.
Mm-hmm.
Garagordabil consistently found that girls scored higher on empathy measures than boys did.
That is a common finding, but it always raises questions for me.
Yeah.
Are we as a society doing enough to nurture empathy in boys?
That's such an important question.
Are we teaching them how to tune into their own feelings?
Mm. And understand other people's perspectives.
And I think that's where, thankfully, Garagordabil's work provides some guidance.
Okay.
She was a strong advocate for social and emotional learning programs.
Okay.
Especially for boys. And, you know, these programs can be really effective,
yeah,
in promoting that empathy and positive social development.
So giving kids the tools and the language to navigate the emotional world,
yes,
it makes sense. It
makes sense.
Now, I know she also did research on the flip side of that antisocial behavior.
Right.
You mentioned a study from the same year, also with 10 to 12 year olds, exploring what contributes to those negative patterns.
Yeah. And this study is a perfect example of how she connects, you know, individual traits to those contextual factors that we talked about.
Right.
So she found that kids who were engaging in antisocial or delinquent behaviors often lacked these key social skills.
Okay.
You know, things like being considerate, controlling impulses,
mm-hmm.
being helpful and assertive.
So a pattern of social difficulties. But it's not just about actions, is it? She also looked at what was going on in their minds and hearts.
Exactly. She discovered that these kids often struggled with low self-esteem.
Okay.
Had kind of negative perceptions of their peers,
mm-hmm.
and showed limited empathy and emotional stability.
Wow.
Plus, they had some trouble with this kind of type of thinking called verbal associative thinking.
Okay.
Which is important for problem solving and creativity.
So a whole web of challenges, social, emotional, and cognitive.
Yeah.
It makes you realize that bad behavior isn't always so simple.
It's complicated.
Did she dig into kind of specific family dynamics or school environments in that study?
Well, that particular study didn't focus on those aspects.
Okay.
You know, her later work on sexism definitely explores the roles of family and school and shaping those attitudes and behaviors.
Gotcha.
But going back to this study, one thing that did emerge was, again, a significant gender difference.
Mm-hmm.
Boys were displaying these antisocial behaviors at much higher rates than girls were.
Again, not a shocking finding.
Right.
But it really does underscore the need to think about these issues differently.
Yeah.
For boys and girls.
For sure.
Are we addressing their needs
right.
in ways that are developmentally appropriate and effective?
I think that's the key question that her work keeps bringing us back to.
Yeah.
And it emphasizes the importance of early intervention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, programs that focus on teaching social skills.
Okay.
Managing emotions.
Mm.
Resolving conflicts peacefully.
So being proactive rather than reactive.
Yes.
When it comes to these challenges.
Absolutely.
Makes sense. Now, I know she did a lot of research with adolescents as well.
Yes.
What were some of the big themes that emerged from her work with teenagers?
Adolescence. Such a fascinating,
right.
sometimes tumultuous time.
Yeah.
You know, Garagordabil really delved into some of those core issues that teens grapple with. Things like self-concept and self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
their overall sense of well-being,
okay.
and that powerful influence of their peers.
Okay, let's start with self-concept and self-esteem.
Right.
Those feel pretty fundamental to how a teenager sees themselves in the world.
Absolutely.
How did she approach those topics?
Well, in 2006, she conducted a study that looked specifically at the connection
mm-hmm.
between self-concept, self-esteem, and these signs of psychological distress in adolescence.
Okay.
It's like she was asking, can a positive sense of self actually protect teens from mental health problems?
It's a fascinating question.
It is.
And what did she find?
The results were pretty clear. Adolescents with higher levels of both self-concept and self-esteem
okay.
were much less likely to report symptoms of things like depression, anxiety, and those physical complaints that we sometimes see linked to stress.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you feel good about yourself, you're probably more resilient in the face of all those challenges that come with being a teenager.
Exactly. It's like having that inner armor to navigate those difficult emotions and experiences. Now, she also looked at gender differences in this study.
Okay.
And the findings were interesting. So while boys reported higher levels of self-esteem than girls did, there was no significant difference in their overall self-concept.
So boys might have more confidence in certain areas.
Yeah.
But their overall sense of self-worth wasn't necessarily stronger than girls.
Exactly. And it just highlights
our understanding of it.
It does. It highlights how important it is to look beyond these simple self-esteem measures.
Right.
We need to understand the different aspects of a teen's self-concept.
Yeah.
How they feel about themselves socially, academically, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
It's about having that well-rounded sense of who you are.
Yeah, that's a great point. And now I'm curious about her work on kind of this psychosocial well-being.
Okay.
You know, how teens feel about their lives overall.
Right.
What were some of the key factors that she identified there?
Well, in 2008, she conducted a study with young adults, so those aged 20 to 40. And she was looking at what contributed to their subjective well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So their sense of happiness and fulfillment.
Got it.
And she explored things like personality traits, social support networks, even how they felt about their material circumstances.
So a mix of internal factors and external realities.
Yes.
What did she discover?
The results pointed to a combination of both, having a positive self-concept and high self-esteem.
Okay.
Again, strongly linked to greater well-being,
mm-hmm.
as was being more extroverted, so enjoying those social connections.
It's not surprising. Feeling good about yourself and having people to support you can make a big difference.
Yeah.
What about the material well-being piece?
Mm-hmm.
Did that play a role?
Interestingly, it did.
Okay.
Individuals who reported feeling financially secure and satisfied with their living situation also tended to have higher levels of psychological well-being.
That's a good reminder that mental health isn't just about internal resilience.
So it's not.
Feeling safe and secure in your environment, having your basic needs met, that matters too.
Absolutely. And, you know, her work really consistently highlights how these individual factors intertwine with that social context.
Right.
It's never just one or the other.
Yeah.
It's always both.
Okay, so we're starting to see these big picture ideas come together.
Yes.
Play, empathy, self-concept, social context.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to take in, but why should we, the listeners, care about all this?
That's a great question.
What's the takeaway message?
Here's where it gets really powerful. You know, Gurria Gordabiel's research isn't just this abstract knowledge.
Right.
It gives us these tangible insights into how to create supportive environments for kids and teens.
Yeah.
How to help them thrive.
I like where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Give us some concrete examples.
Okay. So think about her findings on the power of play in early childhood.
Okay.
This really emphasizes the importance of preschool programs that prioritize playful learning, not just drilling academics.
It's a reminder that play isn't just frivolous fun. It's the foundation for healthy development.
Exactly. And then her work on human rights education shows how targeted interventions can actually reduce prejudice.
Wow.
And nurture empathy. And that's crucial.
Right? Yeah.
For building a more inclusive and just society.
And what about her research on self-concept and well-being?
Yeah.
How do we translate those findings into action?
Well, it really underscores the importance of fostering a strong sense of self in young people, celebrating their strengths, giving them opportunities to succeed, and teaching them those coping skills to manage stress.
Yeah.
It's about building that resilience from the inside out.
It's about giving them the tools to navigate the ups and downs of life.
Absolutely.
And your point about social and emotional learning programs, those connect directly back to her work on empathy, right?
Absolutely. We need to be explicitly teaching kids how to understand and share feelings, how to resolve conflicts peacefully.
Yeah.
These are essential life skills.
It's about equipping them for healthy relationships.
Yes.
And a healthy society.
Exactly.
Now, I know we're about to delve into her work on sexism.
Yes.
Which explores this interplay of individual factors and social context even further.
Yes. Her research on sexism is particularly insightful.
Oh.
Especially when we consider how family and school environments can shape those attitudes about gender.
But before we jump into that, I think it's important to remind our listeners that
yes.
our goal here isn't to, you know, take sides or push any particular agenda.
Absolutely.
We're simply unpacking the content of her research,
yeah,
presenting her findings on these complex issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to each listener to kind of engage with the material,
right,
draw their own conclusions, and maybe even do some further exploration on their own.
Yeah,
well, exactly. We're giving you the starting point. You get to choose the path from here. So with that said, let's dive into her work on sexism.
Okay.
It's a fascinating and often challenging area of research.
Absolutely.
So we're back. And before we went on that little tangent about context,
mm-hmm,
we were about to tackle Gary Gordeau-Biel's work on sexism.
Yes.
Definitely a topic that can spark some strong opinions.
For sure. And as we mentioned earlier,
yeah,
it's so important to, you know, approach this research with nuance.
Yeah.
Really let the findings speak for themselves. And, mm-hmm, you know, Gary Gordeau-Biel wasn't just dipping her toe into this topic.
Right.
She dedicated years to studying it.
Yeah.
Conducted multiple studies across diverse populations.
So this was a major focus for her.
Absolutely.
Can you give us a sense of the big picture?
Yeah.
What were her main goals with this research?
Well, you know, one key objective was to understand how prevalent different forms of sexism are in society.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, you know, the obvious in your face kind,
yeah,
of, but
yeah,
those more subtle and insidious forms that can be harder to pinpoint.
Right, because sexism isn't always about blatant discrimination.
Uh-huh.
It can be about unconscious biases.
Yes.
Those little assumptions that we make, or even seemingly positive attitudes that actually reinforce those traditional gender roles.
Exactly. And that's where I think her work gets so insightful.
Yeah.
She didn't just focus on one type of sexism. You know, she explored this whole spectrum.
Okay.
Including ambivalent sexism, neo-sexism, right, and traditional gender role ideology.
All right, I'm gonna need some definitions here.
Okay.
Let's start with ambivalent sexism.
Okay.
What is that?
So ambivalent sexism is this fascinating mix of both hostile and benevolent attitudes,
okay,
toward women.
Okay.
So hostile sexism is kind of the more straightforward one.
Yeah.
Negative, you know, angry views about women who challenge traditional roles.
So like women belong in the kitchen kind of thinking.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But then there's benevolent sexism.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets tricky.
Okay.
Because it seems positive on the surface.
Right.
It involves those kind of chivalrous attitudes,
mm-hmm,
those seemingly well-intentioned beliefs.
Okay.
That actually kind of reinforce this idea that women are weaker,
okay,
or need protection.
So women are delicate flowers and need to be cherished.
Exactly.
But ultimately, that can be very limiting.
It is, yeah. It puts women on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But doesn't give them that agency.
Exactly.
That's the insidious nature of it.
Yeah, it's harder to recognize,
right,
and challenge,
okay,
because it comes wrapped up in,
yeah,
compliments.
Compliments and concern.
Yeah, okay, so that's ambivalent sexism.
Mm-hmm.
What about neo-sexism?
Okay.
I'm not even sure I've heard that term before.
Yeah, so neo-sexism is kind of this newer form of sexism that sort of emerged.
Okay.
As traditional sexism became less socially acceptable.
Okay.
More subtle, often implicit.
Okay.
And it involves denying that sexism is still a problem.
So we've achieved equality, so we can all move on.
Exactly.
But that ignores these systemic issues that still exist. And the lived experiences of people,
absolutely,
who continue to face discrimination.
Yeah, yeah. And then alongside those forms of sexism,
okay,
she also studied traditional gender role ideology.
Okay.
So those deeply held beliefs about the proper roles,
right,
for men and women,
yeah,
which are often based on these rigid stereotypes.
So she was covering a lot of ground here.
A lot of ground.
What about the people that she studied? Who were her participants?
You know, her research included such a wide range of folks.
Yeah.
Adolescents, adults, men, women.
Wow.
People from different socioeconomic backgrounds.
Okay.
She also did cross-cultural comparisons, examining sexism in both Spain and Colombia.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
With all that data, I'm sure some pretty clear patterns emerged.
Oh, yeah.
What were some of the key things that she discovered?
Well, one consistent finding was that men, regardless of their age or cultural background, tended to have higher levels of hostile sexism compared to women.
I guess that's not totally surprising, but it's still important to acknowledge. What about benevolent sexism?
Okay.
Did she find any differences there?
Interestingly, both men and women endorsed benevolent sexist attitudes.
Okay.
Although men were slightly more likely to do so.
Okay.
And I think that highlights how pervasive these seemingly positive,
right,
but ultimately limiting beliefs can be.
Yeah.
They're often operating beneath our awareness.
It really shows how these subtle forms of sexism can fly under the radar,
yeah,
even among people who wouldn't consider themselves sexist.
Right.
Were there any connections between sexism and other attitudes or behaviors?
Yes. This is where the research gets even more interesting.
Okay.
So Gary Gordabil found that sexism in its various forms was often linked to things like racism, authoritarianism.
Wow.
You know, having a very rigid hierarchical worldview.
Right.
Low levels of empathy and even difficulties with emotional regulation.
So it's not just about gender.
Right.
It seems to be part of this larger constellation of attitudes and behaviors that can be harmful.
It is.
To individuals and to society.
Absolutely. And, you know, her research also suggested that these sexist attitudes can be transmitted.
Oh, wow.
Across generations, particularly through family dynamics.
Ah, the cycle of prejudice. How did that show up in her findings?
Well, she found that parents' sexist attitudes, especially those of the mother,
okay,
were significantly correlated with the sexist views of their children.
Wow.
Both sons and daughters.
So it's like those beliefs can get passed down.
Yes.
Almost like a family heirloom.
It is.
Unless we actively challenge them.
Exactly.
It really underscores how important it is to address sexism within families. Kids are like sponges. They absorb the messages they see and hear. Hmm. And if their parents are modeling those sexist beliefs,
right,
it's likely to shape their worldview.
And it's not just those overt statements.
Right.
It's those subtle cues, the unspoken expectations,
yeah,
can be even more powerful.
We have to be mindful of those underlying messages.
Yes, absolutely.
We're sending. Mm. It's about questioning those assumptions that perpetuate,
right,
gender inequality.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned earlier that she also looked at the influence of school environments.
Yes.
What did her research reveal about that?
So she found that schools that actively promote, you know,
yeah,
diversity, inclusion, critical thinking, tend to foster less sexist attitudes,
okay,
among students.
Got it.
On the flip side, you know, schools that reinforce those traditional gender roles and hierarchies,
yeah,
might unintentionally be contributing to the problem.
This highlights the crucial role that education plays in shaping these attitudes and behaviors.
Absolutely.
It's not just about academics.
Right.
It's about creating a learning environment that values equality,
yes,
and challenges prejudice.
Exactly. And her work really makes the case for, you know,
yeah,
comprehensive sexism prevention programs,
okay,
that target not just individuals, but also the systems and structures,
yeah,
that perpetuate these beliefs.
So tackling it from multiple angles, individual awareness,
yeah,
family dynamics, school environments, it's a complex issue.
It is.
Requires a multifaceted approach.
Absolutely.
With all this research on sexism, it'd be easy to just feel discouraged.
Right.
But I'm curious, did Garrett Gordabil offer any solutions, any pathways towards creating a more gender equitable society?
Absolutely. You know, her research wasn't just about identifying the problem.
Yeah.
It was about finding ways to create positive change.
No.
And she consistently advocated for interventions,
yeah,
that promote empathy, critical thinking, and respectful communication.
So giving people the tools to examine their own biases and engage in constructive dialogue.
Yeah.
And she emphasized the importance of starting early in childhood,
yeah,
before those sexist attitudes become deeply entrenched.
Right.
It's about laying the foundation,
yes,
for a more equitable future where gender is no longer a barrier to opportunity or fulfillment.
That's a powerful vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, her work reminds us that creating this more gender equitable world,
yeah,
is a collective responsibility.
It is.
You know, involving individuals, families, schools, and society as a whole.
It's a reminder that we all have a role to play in challenging sexism.
Yes.
And promoting equality.
Absolutely.
And that's a great note to end on.
Yeah.
You know, as we wrap up our deep dive into Mate Garagorda Bill's research,
mm-hmm.
I'm left with this sense of awe for her dedication to this field.
Yeah.
And to our listeners, we encourage you to delve deeper into the topics that resonated with you today.
Yes.
Garagorda Bill's research offers this wealth of insight.
It does.
It's a journey worth taking.
Keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep striving.
Yes.
To create a world where all children, regardless of gender,
yeah.
have the opportunity to thrive.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.